Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And, you know, I think across the country, I can say, if I have a skewed view here living on the East Coast, but ramen has taken off like crazy. It's one of those, I don't want to say fad foods, but indeed it has sort of taken on a faddish type popularity. And most everyone, I'm sure, had their first introduction to ramen in one of those styrofoam cups or one of those little dry packets that you'd, you know, dip in hot water. Hey, it got a lot of you through school, no doubt. But ramen is a lot more than that. And if any of you have noticed in the recent popularity of the shops and stopped in and had a wonderful steaming bowl of slurpy noodles in a ramen shop. How did this popularity come about, and where did ramen really come from? My guest today is George Solt, who has written a wonderful book called The Untold History of Ramen, How Political Crisis in Japan Spawned a Global Food Craze. And George spent quite a bit of time researching this food, and I'm sure ate quite a bit of ramen. George is an assistant professor of modern Japanese history in the Department of History at NYU. Here in the city, and he completed his doctorate at UC San Diego on the topic of ramen. He really took ramen seriously, and he considers the connections between political, economic transformation, and social reorganization of Japan in the modern era. We're not just talking about looking at the history of the noodle soup. I mean, there's a lot that goes on here. So I am so pleased to welcome George. Welcome, George, to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
George recently gave a wonderful presentation to the Culinary Historians of New York, but of course, not everybody could attend that, and they saw all the advertising and the notices for it, and then all the responses on Twitter and the articles and all the magazines. So I'm really pleased to be able to give you time to talk about it again, that our listeners all across the country, in fact internationally, can hear this wonderful story about ramen. So I'm going to start off asking, well, how old is ramen anyway?
Thanks. And it was a real pleasure giving that talk at the Culinary Historians. Thanks for inviting me in today, too. But where does it come from? That's kind of where I started this whole project. And that's the first question I wanted to answer when I started the research. And it turns out there's basically three different versions of how you can explain where ramen originates from. It's, of course, Chinese food originally that entered Japan. And the question of when it entered Japan and how it entered Japan is a matter of some debate. There's one theory that it entered in the 1660s through basically a Ming scholar who was escaping China as a refugee. There's another theory that it entered in the 1880s with Chinese workmen who were cooking in Western-style restaurants which served Chinese food. And there's also a version that it started in the 1910s with a Japanese cook who basically hired a lot of Chinese cooks from Chinatown to begin serving a new kind of food that was based on a Chinese dish, but took on many new forms, new ingredients, and new flavorings that made it more domesticated for Japanese consumers. And so there's three different ways to approach even the origin of this food. And 1665, 1884, or 1910 are three different ways you could kind of explain how this food from China entered Japan and which group it entered through.
Well, let's talk about the old dynasty story, because that obviously has, you know, a lot of intrigue and history to it. If
yes.
indeed, you know, it, there's veracity in it. And but before we go there,
yes.
are all of the end products, the dishes, similar? Is there something that sets them apart from just plain old bowl of noodle soup?
Well, yes, ramen is very different from what had been served in Japan until that time. So until basically the introduction of Western foodstuffs in mass culture, which happened in the late 19th century, Japanese didn't eat too much meat. It was really a vegetarian and fish-based, marine-based food culture. So the noodle soups that were available in Japan were kind of vegetable and seafood-based soups. So that idea of ramen being a new food and what made it so different was really the meat that was used in the broth and the meat that was used in the topping. This is what made it a completely new form of noodle soup.
And it is a very, very rich meat broth, usually pork or chicken.
Yes, and very salty and very starchy as well. So these components really fit the new kind of necessities created by industrialization and Japan's entry into a new economic kind of era that happened in the late 19th century. So all of this is connected to kind of global politics and how international changes affect food habits in Japan.
So to you, that story is more interesting than the
That's
the
really
oldest.
Kind of...
Okay,
yes. Sorry. Anyway,
you go I'll, there. Go
no,
there.
I'm sorry, I'll go back to the 1665.
I want to know how the politics really influenced the food.
Yes, absolutely. So for the question of Japan, rice is really the main staple grain of Japan, and it has been for a long time. There are people that consume a lot of kind of sweet potatoes, millet, other kinds of grains, but rice has always had a special place in the Japanese kind of cultural history. So the idea of consuming a lot of wheat was very foreign and not part of the Japanese eating culture until the late 19th century again, when British and American food culture really enter through changes in international relations that Japan was experiencing. So the shift from basically a rice-based staple grain diet to a diet that incorporates a lot of wheat flour was made possible by first the interaction with America and Britain, and later really through the occupation after the war. I hate to jump ahead too far in time.
No, that's understandable.
The 1940s and 1950s really drastically transformed Japanese people's idea of what everyday sustenance is. And until that point, the idea of eating wheat flour-based noodles every day as a form of nourishment for workers was not too common. But really, with the influx of wheat that happened with the American occupation in 1945 and then ending in 1952, the Japanese dietary habits changed drastically. So this is where ramen comes into the story, where ramen becomes something that's available really throughout the country, widely to all groups of people, as an alternative to rice, which was scarce at that time.
Well, I know ramen, in fact, on the cover of your book, you have a picture of a food cart.
Yes.
Was ramen originally sold from little stalls and carts, or
yes.
were there? Was that because restaurants you were no longer serving it?
Absolutely. So the food cart, or the yatai, is absolutely the origin of Japanese ramen. And until basically the turn of the century, the early 1900s, these food carts were selling soba. So it was a very common thing in Japanese cities to find noodle vendors, but they wouldn't sell Chinese-style noodle soups, which incorporated the meat and the broth made of meat. So that really happened around the early 1900s, 1910s. And the push carts shifted from soba push carts to ramen push carts, and then that's really the origin. But what happened is during the occupation period, because of the great demand for ramen, a lot of these pushcart vendors were able to convert their small stands into small-scale shops. So the shops sprouted up all over, but some of the most famous ramen shops, the one that originated Sapporo Ramen, the one that originated a lot of these regional specialty ramen, come from these pushcarts that started really in the 1910s, 1920s. So the pushcart is the site that this ramen phenomenon can really see originating from.
Well, you mentioned the influx of American culture through the occupation and otherwise.
Yes.
I have a question, and then because he's mentioned in the book, and my question to you is, what does General MacArthur have to do with the popularity of ramen?
So General MacArthur has everything to do with the popularity of ramen, and this is kind of counterintuitive, but The great food shortages that Japanese experienced in 1946 and 1947 created a deep political crisis in Japan, where a lot of people were criticizing the occupation authorities, the American occupation authorities, and the Japanese bureaucrats who were basically inadequately managing the food system and the rationing system. So as the rationing system was breaking down and people were really criticizing the government and becoming politically anti-American to some extent, top government officials in Washington decided to send more wheat to Japan at the request of MacArthur. MacArthur was saying there's going to be a violent crisis in Japan if more food is not imported, because we are at the brink of starvation here. So as a result, top-level cabinet meetings were held, and food was shipped to Japan in much greater quantities than initially planned at the beginning of this famine-like condition, 1946, 1947. And when the ramen, when the wheat flour arrived in Japan, a lot of it took the form of ramen noodle soup, because small wheat millers were the ones in charge of milling, and they would divert some of their wheat supplies to small-scale ramen stall operators. So this is really where you find the connection between mass-scale consumption of ramen in Japan and the American decision to send a lot of wheat to Japan for basically political purposes, keeping Japanese on track to be democratized and demilitarized in the way that the U.S. authorities were hoping for.
And then did they take up the agricultural practice of growing wheat, and did it grow
In certain areas? Japan grew a significant portion of the wheat all the way up to the 60s. So there was a lot of wheat grown in Hokkaido, and wheat was actually exported until the 1960s, when the wheat imports from America became so cheap and so abundant that it became economically basically irrational to grow wheat in Japan. But until that point, there was an effort to grow Japanese wheat in certain regions where the space allowed. But the lack of kind of open space for growing things like wheat in Japan really hindered that sector of the agricultural development.
Well, then in your book, you include a lot of talk about ramen on the black market. What happened to create a black market for that?
So because of the high demand for food and the scarcity of food during the war, basic goods became rationed. And so it became illegal to operate a restaurant in Japan during the wartime, after 1942. And the occupation authorities, when the Americans arrived, they decided to keep the system in place because the food shortages were continuing. And the idea of having a restaurant operating where people were openly kind of
congregating
and consuming vast amounts of food based on their economic means rather than the greater social need of the whole country was seen as politically kind of damaging. So they maintained the rationing system and decided to keep restaurant food vending outlawed until 1949, when food supplies were high enough to allow for open food vending. But because of this, people who were buying and selling ramen between 1945 and 1949 were often jailed, and you have a lot of occupation records of people arrested and imprisoned for selling ramen or
even
buying
just in
ramen.
A stall. Even just in a stall.
These stalls were rounded up, and the operators were basically jailed en masse. And so you have these records of hundreds of people jailed, and a lot of them were selling ramen. Not all of them, but about 20% from what I found of people arrested were selling ramen from the records I saw. Mm-hmm. It's not a complete kind of analysis, but.
And then when that was lifted in like 49.
Yes, and so around 50 is when a lot of these street stalls become openly successful businesses that are being erected in the suburbs, which are being rebuilt as Japan's economy is rehabilitating. And of course, this has everything to do with the Korean War. The Korean War was a big part of the recovery of the Japanese economy because of all the procurement orders from the U.S. military placed with the Japanese. So as the Japanese economy recovered, ramen was being served more in shops and nice small-scale eateries rather than the push carts that had dominated the bombed-out cityscape in 1940s.
Interesting. Well, you grew up in Japan. I mean, you were born in Japan and grew up in Japan until you were about 10. Were you surprised at this renewed or this new popularity of ramen in the United States?
Absolutely. To be honest, I never thought this would happen. I started this as a project studying ramen in Japan and how significant this food was in kind of articulating post-war history and the Japanese sense of identity, especially in the post-90s, the recessionary era. But to think that this would be kind of a global phenomenon where Americans were really excited about ramen flavorings and recipes, this is something I would have never predicted, because I started this 12 years ago before these shops really took off. Mm-hmm. And ramen was something that Japanese businessmen kind of consumed when they were doing work in America. And so you had small shops that catered to Japanese expatriate businessmen, but there weren't too many shops that had American customers enjoying the food. And so this is something that was really kind of a new development for me and very interesting. That's why my last chapter was something I wrote basically after 2009, after I finished my degree, because these are all new developments that I hadn't really accounted for while studying the Japanese, the role of this food in Japan.
Right. Well, as I always say, everything old is new again.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you some more questions about ramen, specifically in America, too, when we come back after a brief break.
You are listening to Favorite Flower by Pamela Royal here on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Stay tuned for more from A Taste of the Past. The program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with George Sult, the author of The Untold History of Ramen. And George, what basically is the difference between ramen and like a Chinese or Japanese noodle soup, or say soba or something? What's the noodles always seem a little different.
Yes, there's an alkali component, or what they call kansui, and I was corrected about this. I actually made an error last time. I was talking about how it's alkali-laced noodles, and it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. It's part sodium carbonate and part sodium potassium, and those two things put together with water give it an alkalinity, which gives...
Like we would make a cake dough.
Exactly. It's like baking soda, but
springy and puffy.
And that's why the ramen noodles are a little chewier and they're a little yellower and they have a distinct odor that ramen shops give off, which is very separate from soba or udon or the other kind of noodles that are popular in Japan. Mm.
Well, I mean, it really became so important in not only the economy as it grew, but in practical reasons, health reasons, and nutrition. I mean, it was a nutritious dish, right?
Absolutely. It was considered much more filling, and it filled up the the caloric demands of the heavy industrial workers. So there was a lot of construction happening in Japan in the 1950s and 1960s, just as the economic reindustrialization of the country went forward. And that really meant a lot of workers from the countryside coming to the city in the agricultural off-season to build the new skyscrapers and construct the new roads and highways and waterways. And all this construction was, in a sense, fueled by a lot of the cheap wheat flour that was coming in from Australia, Canada, and the United States at preferential rates because of the Cold War agreements between Japan and America. But basically, the cheap wheat flour really reindustrialized the economy by satisfying the demand for high caloric food among workers. And so it was the wheat flour, the oiliness of the soup, and the meat in
the
dish.
It was a quick meal. You could, you know, didn't have to take time off your work, right?
Definitely. And it was usually affordable too.
Yeah. So, well, even the wheat, you mentioned the wheat that was coming in, a lot of it was black market wheat.
Yeah, that was during the occupation period when restaurant vending was outlawed. So until 49, there was illegal wheat trade going on. Behind the official wheat trade, which was not enough to cover the food needs of the entire populace. But after the 50s, it became completely legal to eat ramen. It wasn't a black market operation anymore, except for unlicensed pushcart vendors, which remained a...
Well, that's always a problem.
Yeah. Exactly. It's always a problem. And that's something that remains, actually, in Japan. You can find kind of pushcarts that are still unlicensed that do sell ramen, and they're some of the best places to enjoy the dish, even though they're getting harder and harder to find.
Yeah. Well, something, of course, did occur that changed the whole landscape of ramen as we all first knew it, and
yes,
that was the invention of these of the dried packets.
Absolutely. In 1958, the first instant ramen was released. It was called chikin ramen, and it was sold at a department store to great fanfare. Housewives were lining up, eager to try this new product, and it was a sign of the novelty of the technology, really something you could reconstitute in 2 minutes, they said initially. Later, they said 3 minutes, but at first it was 2 minutes. And also, they marketed it as a health food in the beginning, believe it or not. They said this is packed with vitamins, packed with nutrition. It's a complete meal, even though it only takes 3 minutes, and this is something you want to give your children.
With that little flavor packet?
Absolutely, yes. Well, the flavoring was actually incorporated into the noodles in the very first version, so that was already kind of part of the crispy noodles, but yes, 1958.
So was the original in the that flat cake form of the noodles?
Yes,
you know, with
the,
that stiff thing you try to break. Yeah, the pillow of noodles. Well, it was a little hard for a pillow.
right.
And then it segued into the cup of soup type.
Yes, that was a 1971 that was released.
Ooh.
And it was a little bit later, but that's really the kind of iconic instant noodle that Americans usually think about when they think of the instant version, the cup of noodle soup, even though there's Top Ramen that was released earlier among Americans, too. But
well, I know you had some, in a presentation I saw, you had some wonderful slides that showed the ramen museum.
Yes.
I can't believe there's a museum totally devoted to ramen.
It's an amazing place. It was established in 1994. It cost $38 million to build, and there's 9 ramen shops that you can try their food there. And they rotate different ramen shops in the museum every couple of years. So it's always the top stores of Japan. But it's a nice way to taste ramen, learn about ramen, and also buy some packaged ramen to take home.
And there's all these colorful displays of, you know, cartoons and activities and fun things for the kids.
There is, right? Because it's made in the image of 1958 Tokyo. And again, 1958 is this crucial year for ramen because it's the year instant ramen's released. And it's also the year when Japanese were still seeing themselves as kind of the best days are ahead. The economy's about to grow, and catching up with America is still a goal that is very seriously considered by workers in the time. So 1958 is a moment of nostalgia, and they rebuilt Tokyo to look like it was 1958 Tokyo in this ramen museum to take you back to that moment when the future was still bright and ramen was available everywhere.
Well, is it true that Momofuku is the one attributed with actual inventing the instant ramen?
Yes. So he's the founder of Nissin Foods Corporation. Mm-hmm. And
those are the packets that we first knew from.
Definitely.
And still do and still see.
They're the world's top producer of instant ramen, and they do a lot of good work in terms of disaster relief. But definitely, they were the ones that popularized instant ramen. And in 1958, they released it to create fanfare, but there is some debate about whether they actually invented the instant ramen or not. There was another company that invented it, a very similar product, and released it 2 years earlier, but it never took on, and they didn't patent this technology, so they never actually got credit for originating. But that was Matsuda Sangyo, and the product was re-released later as a snack, which is broken up flavored instant ramen, which is known as Baby Star Ramen. You can still buy it today, but yeah, they never got the press and the launch that Nissin Foods was able to enjoy.
Well, indeed, I mean, a food that is so popular that they erected a statue to Momofuku.
Yes.
I mean, that's...
That's amazing. There's instant ramen, not just...
Instant ramen, right.
Museum, yes. So yeah. There's the ramen museum and then the instant ramen museum. And the instant ramen museum's in Osaka, but the ramen museum's in Tokyo. So they're both definitely worth checking out.
Interesting. So are ramen shops still popular in Japan as they are here in America today?
Absolutely. They are, but it's interesting because the founder of the ramen museum wrote a book a few years back called... The Day the Sun Sets on Ramen. And he was basically lamenting the twilight of passionate ramen consumption in Japan, saying people don't drive 3 hours to taste a new ramen anymore. People don't line up as much as they used to. And all the ramen that used to be so distinct regionally are starting to taste more and more the same. So there's a homogenization of the flavors that is worrisome. So he wrote a whole book basically saying maybe the great heyday of ramen consumption is over in Japan already. And this was happening right at the time when American ramen fanfare was taking off to new heights. So there's kind of a baton passing, if you will, or something like that.
Or maybe maybe there's going to be a renewed interest in
maybe,
Japan.
Yes, maybe it'll go back to Japan.
Well, and you brought up the regional variations, and I found that really interesting because there are distinct types of ramen served in different areas. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, so each area had a different type of ramen developed. And so, for example, Sapporo ramen in the north has miso-flavored ramen, and their noodles are thicker, and they usually use some kind of garlic in the soup, so that's considered Sapporo ramen. And people say it's because it's cold there. You want something even saltier than you would find in Tokyo, and the noodles have to be thicker to absorb that extra hearty soup.
And is it a pork broth, or is it
it's
primarily
pork?
Primarily
yes.
Pork, okay.
So, So that would be chicken. I'm sorry, I'm confusing it with Hakata ramen. Hakata ramen is pork broth and thin noodles, and that would be from Kyushu. And people in Kyushu tend to prefer pork-based broth, not chicken-based broth. And that's the one that is very popular in America, where it's a milky white soup with a heavy pork bone soup component. But that's also a regional specialty of the southwest of Japan. And in the noodles there, they don't put alkali in the noodles, so you don't have the springy, chewy yellow noodles that you do in other parts. But Hokkaido is perhaps the opposite, where you have very high alkali content in the noodles, so they're very chewy and springy, and that's considered the distinct specialty of that region's ramen. So in the 1980s, people began traveling around the country to taste different regional ramen in Japan, and they would write about it. They would televise their experience on reality TV, gourmet shows, and a lot of things were basically pointing to the regional distinctiveness of these different ramen. And again, the founder of the Ramen Museum saying that kind of passionate consumption is waning in Japan, so he's a little concerned.
Well, I know there was concern for all the new ramen shops especially in New York right now,
yes.
Is that the hot summer is coming. And who wants to stand over a steaming hot bowl of ramen with hot summer? But there is an answer, right?
Absolutely. And summer ramen is all about late night ramen, actually. So the idea originally is, again, the push cart being the original site. After drinking routines require some kind of heavy charge of carbohydrate infusion. So that
would be greasy, carby food, right?
Exactly. And that was the role that ramen was supposed to serve. So there is a role for ramen in late summer night eating, I think.
Yeah, but there's a cold ramen dish as well. But is that not really a true ramen?
No, that's great. Hiyashi chuka is one of them. Or they also have like hiyashi ramen, which is another thing that's more popular these days. But yeah, summertime is all about hiyashi chuka, or at least it was for me when I was growing up. That's good stuff.
Late night ramen.
Late
right?
night ramen.
You're a late
too.
Night ramen man. Well, there are certainly so many interesting stories that surround ramen, and I'm sure the one about the old dynasty, which we do have to touch on a little bit because I teased, you know, the topic.
Oh, right.
And it's not, I mean, since it's such a popular food for a country, I'm sure that having this very decorative type of important story kind of elevates it a little bit. But tell us a little bit about that story.
Absolutely. So in 1987, a food historian called Kosuge Keiko wrote basically the first book examining the history of ramen in Japan. And she said that there was a scholar from Ming China who escaped to Japan in the 1660s, whose name was Zhu Shun Shui. And he lived with Mito Mitsukuni, who was a feudal lord of Japan, and he was second in line to the shogun. Now, Mito Mitsukuni employed Zhu Shun Shui as an advisor, but it turns out they both loved noodle soup, and Mito Mitsukuni, being an avid consumer of udon, which of course was the thicker wheat flour noodle with a marine-based soup flavoring, wanted to enjoy a new form of noodle soup. So Zhu Shun Shui prepared for him what he thought would be a more tasty version of the noodle soup, which was basically five spices incorporated into the udon that Mito Mitsukuni was eating. And so these five spices collectively were known as ushin, or five spices, and this became the definitive component of Mito regional ramen. So Mito regional ramen became known as ushin ramen. But Kosuge Keiko's account of how Zhu Shun Shui introduced udon's five flavorings to ramen, to udon in Japan, became the origin story for how Chinese noodle soup was introduced to Japan in the 1660s. So this is a very roundabout way of telling how the first Japanese person to consume Chinese noodle soup ended up doing so. It's a very circular kind of narrative. But
well, of course, it had to be somebody of power, or it wouldn't have
exactly
wouldn't hold any broth.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting to learn about those minor differences of the soups. I'm not minor to some people, but
right.
But something that we haven't mentioned is that what really differentiates it from some of the other, like the udon soups and things,
yes,
is the addition of meat.
Correct? Yes. The chashu, which is the roasted pork, sometimes it's stewed pork, but that's really one of the components that really makes Japanese ramen different from anything else that had been served in Japan until then in terms of noodle soup.
Mm, so you do have a complete meal in a bowl. Yeah.
That's the idea, yes. And that's why vegetarian ramen is very much very uncommon in Japan. It's hard to find a good vegetarian ramen.
Although there's some excellent vegetarian ramens that here in America that they've adapted, obviously, to capture that market.
It's very impressive.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, but the original ramen is not vegetarian.
Would not be a vegetarian dish. Yes.
Interesting. Well, I don't know about you listening in, but I need a big bowl of something salty and full of carbohydrate noodles and maybe a couple slices of meat. George,
yes, that's great.
Thank you so much, George.
Thank
Salt,
you,
the author of The Untold History of Ramen. And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.